This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Find out what's new. What's new?
Chemistry.
Botany.
Evolution.
Information technology.
Cosmology.
Mathematics. Ecology.
Oceanography.
Planetary science.
Medicine.
Biotechnology.
Astronomy.
Welcome to SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on the March 10th edition of SciPod, directed by Darwin. You might think that humans have stopped evolving, but our genes tell a different story. Weighty matters. Putting Einstein's famous formula to the test, one atom at a time. And from a paradise in peril to a wireless toast, we'll raise a glass to this week's science news. But first, it all started billions of years ago, when one little molecule made a slightly less than perfect copy of itself. Since then, evolution has populated our planet with a remarkable array of life forms, including us. But is evolution finished with the human species? Until recently, the accepted answer was yes, meaning that we are essentially the same humans we were 50,000 years ago when Homo sapiens sapiens was new on the scene. Now it seems that conclusion may have been a bit premature. Bruce Lahn is an associate professor of human genetics at the University of Chicago. And as he told New Scientist's Ivan Semenek, human evolution is really a state of mind.
Dr. Lahn, your research involves the genetic basis of brain evolution. What is that research telling us about how humans have changed over the past several thousand years?
Our research has shown that a number of genes that have experienced very strong selection in the lineage leading to our species might still be undergoing very dramatic changes that are still driven by selection within modern human populations since humans as a species have emerged a couple of hundreds of thousands of years ago and perhaps continuing to this day.
And what kind of functions are these genes connected to? I mean, if they're evolving, how do they make us different from our ancestors?
The two genes that we are studying in particular are called microcephalin and ASPM. For both genes, we know that they control brain size during development, in that when they're mutated in humans, the individuals carrying the mutations would have a brain size that's far smaller than the normal range. And we also know that these genes have changed in very dramatic ways in the lineage leading to our species over tens of millions of years of evolutionary time. And what we found more recently is that for each one of these two genes, a new genetic variant emerged very recently for microcephalin about 37,000 years ago, and for ASPM only about 5,800 years ago. And this new genetic variant has gone from a single copy when it first emerged to anywhere between 30 to 80% of worldwide population today.
This is truly remarkable because when you talk about just 5,800 years, we're now talking within the boundaries of what we would call civilization or within the historic record, essentially. So what could be driving such a recent change and how could that be disseminated through the population?
Well, we can only speculate. First of all, given that these genes are involved in determining brain size, we argue that the new variants that are under very strong selection, which basically drove these new variants from single copy to high frequency, could in some way affect brain function, not necessarily brain size per se, but some aspect of brain biology. And secondly, given that these genes have evolved in very dramatic ways in the longer evolutionary history of our species, that is over the last 10, 20, 30 million years of hominid evolution, we argue that dramatic changes in these genes might have to do with brain size, actually. And the emergence of these new variants, even though they're not necessarily related to brain size, might nevertheless be very important to brain function. So I do need to qualify here and say that we don't know exactly what these new variants do yet, but I can make speculations based on the functions of these genes. So obviously, we and others are studying what these new variants actually confer based on our hunch that it may have to do with brain biology. So it could be cognitive abilities, it could be brain morphology, it could be something that's related to personality. We don't know yet, but those are the possibilities that should be explored.
Now, just to pursue this a little further, is there any sense of where geographically these variations could have arisen and what could have fueled them?
Well, again, I can only speculate, and these speculations could seed further research, but they should be understood as, you know, as that is speculations.
Sure.
So for microcephalin, we found that the variant that is under positive selection has a high frequency for much of the world outside of Africa, and it's somewhat lower in Africa, suggesting that it might have arisen outside of Africa, even though it doesn't necessitate that possibility. And for ASPM, the frequency of the variant that's under positive selection is high in Europe and also Middle East and surrounding regions such as Pakistan and North Africa, suggesting that it might have had a European or Middle East or West Asia origin and basically spread from, you know, wherever this new variant originated. But again, it doesn't necessitate that. It could be that originally in Africa and then was brought out of Africa by people migrating around, but for whatever reason, they just went up in frequency in one region more so than the other. And as to what is about the different geographical regions that drive up the frequency in one region and not the other, you know, I guess I can only speculate that there may be regional differences in selection, and also depending on where the new variant first originated, there may actually not be much regional variation in selection, but if it's originally in, let's say, around Europe, then the frequency went up in Europe first before the new variant had a chance to move to the other parts of the world.
Right. Now, it certainly seems like a surprise. I know that this work is coming as a bit of a surprise, and I suppose one reason is that if we look at the classical definition of evolution, don't we find that evolutionary divergence or evolutionary change is something that we should expect where we have small populations that are geographically separated? I'm thinking of Darwin's finches, for example, and clearly the human population today certainly is neither small nor separated. You know, you could fly around the world in theory and mix your genes by mating with anyone, mating with people with very different backgrounds. So doesn't that effectively put the brakes on human evolution? And if so, how can this be happening?
Well, I actually think that the fact that human populations are a lot larger, particularly today, or even just, you know, a few thousand years ago than what it had been historically, pre-civilization, doesn't necessarily put a brake on human evolution. It'll just change the dynamics of human evolution. So I would imagine that with people moving around, a genetically adaptive variant would now spread across the globe rather than, you know, just spreading in a local region more rapidly than would have been the case if humans were more isolated. I would also argue that with modern lifestyle, certain traits that were under selection may no longer be under selection, whereas other traits that were previously not under strong selection might now come under selection. So I think it'll just be sort of different regimes and different dynamics, but I don't think that selection would necessarily stop once, you know, we've become a large population that can move around easily.
Now, when we were talking about the geographic distribution of these variations, you were being cautious, and I think admirably so, about getting too fixated on whether, you know, for example, one gene is prevalent in Africa versus Europe, for example. And I guess one reason to be cautious is that this is precisely the kind of thing that could fuel prejudice, that could fuel racism, in fact. And is that something that concerns you, or is it even something that scientists should be concerned about when they're working on this kind of research?
Well, it certainly concerns me, and I think it should be something that scientists should be concerned with. You know, we are very careful in saying that, you know, we only found two genes that have this distribution pattern, and the distribution patterns differ between these two genes. So right there, you know that if you find additional genes, their distribution patterns will likely differ from gene to gene. And if you look at many genes that are possibly under selection in modern human populations, with regard to a particular population, things may come out in the wash. So in other words, there may be many other genes for which the adaptive variant may be high in Africa and low in other places. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, a few years later we actually find such genes. Additionally, we also need to know that we don't know yet what these new variants in these genes do. So cognitive abilities and such are a possibility, but there could be other possibilities that are potentially rather different from what we consider as sort of cognition. So I think we just need more data to be able to know better about population differences in terms of selection. And I think, you know, before that, it's just premature to draw any conclusions based on one or two genes as to whether one population is, on average, more advantageous or not. I mean, that's just, you know, absolutely absurd.
Right. And you know, the more we speak, the more it's clear that we're just at the tip of the iceberg, aren't we? There seems to be so much more work yet to do. Where do you see this research going next? And what are we ultimately going to, where is it ultimately going to take us in terms of our understanding of ourselves?
Well, I think, you know, for the two genes that we're focusing on, we obviously want to know what the new variants actually do in terms of functional consequence. We also want to better understand their evolutionary history above and beyond what we have already discovered. But, you know, speaking perhaps on behalf of the field, I would say that as a field, what we're looking to understand is the complex interaction between genes and selection, and also human demography and human history. And basically, through the study of many genes and how that, you know, relate to many various selective events, we can have a better appreciation of how humans have evolved in the recent past. And I have to say that part of that understanding would relate to population differences for either a given gene or maybe a set of genes. And I think that that has to be dealt with very carefully. You know, as you said, that could be used by some people to perhaps advance their agenda of racial prejudice. And we want to make sure that whatever understandings come out of this type of study would actually make us understand ourselves better in a way that's constructive to, you know, our living together in harmony and our appreciating not only our similarities but also our differences and perhaps celebrating our differences rather than using that as a way of dividing people.
Well, it certainly suggests the more we know, the better. And, you know, this is really a fascinating discussion. So, Dr. Lan, thanks very much. And I hope you, I think you've evolved our awareness of the entire issue to some extent. So I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you for having me.
We reached Bruce Lan in Chicago. You can find out more about the changing views on human evolution in this week's edition of New Scientist, where you can be sure that every story is naturally selected for your reading pleasure.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Now here is Donna Page and Jeffrey Whittle with this week's science news.
One of the most ecologically diverse places on Earth could also be the most at risk from global warming. New Guinea is considered a biological paradise because its relative isolation and mountainous terrain has fostered the evolution of many unique species. Now, researchers say that paradise is disappearing faster than it can be explored. The evidence for this dismal assessment comes in the form of decades worth of meteorological data recorded by missions, coffee plantations, and mining companies that operate in New Guinea's remote highland regions. Climate scientists in the U.S. analyzed the data and found that New Guinea is heating up 20 times faster than previously thought. The warming appears to be particularly severe at the highest altitudes, where some of the last remaining glaciers in tropical Asia have been undergoing a rapid retreat. Researchers are now working to extract ice cores from those glaciers before they disappear. The cores should reveal a detailed climate history of New Guinea going back thousands of years. Meanwhile, hosts of newly discovered animal and plant species have been announced in recent weeks, including a new genus of palm trees and a tree kangaroo. Scientists fear this diversity will be lost as New Guinea's mountain forests wilt in the soaring heat.
Budget shortfalls have forced NASA to shelve its mission to search for Earth-like planets around other stars, but there may still be a way to do it for a fraction of the cost. Next month, a team of astronomers and engineers will propose a mission that could spot alien Earths by flying a flower-shaped disk in front of the James Webb Space Telescope. That telescope is currently in development and is due to replace the Hubble Space Telescope in the summer of 2013. Although it's more powerful than Hubble, it cannot spot Earth-like planets on its own because those planets are simply too dim compared to the stars they orbit. The proposed flying disk would hover 30,000 kilometers in front of the telescope, where it would act as a mask, blocking the light of target stars while revealing the planets circling around them. The shape of the disk, which sports a dozen spiked petals, is designed to reduce the effect of light waves bending around the edges of the disk, a problem known as diffraction. If it's approved, the disk could launch just 3 months behind the James Webb Telescope and start hunting for alien Earths soon after that.
A personalized vaccine that could stop multiple sclerosis in its tracks is scheduled to undergo a new trial this month. MS occurs when renegade white blood cells attack the myelin cells that surround and protect nerves and brain tissue. The new vaccine is made by taking some of those renegade cells from a patient, multiplying them in the lab, and weakening them with radiation. The weakened cells are then reinjected into the patient, whose immune system will recognize them as damaged and attack them. Once activated in this way, the patient's immune system will also attack healthy renegade cells. In a smaller trial with 15 patients with MS, the rate of new flare-ups was reduced by 92%. If this success is repeated in the new trial, it might mean that regular shots could slow or even arrest the progress of the disease.
And finally, researchers at MIT's Media Lab have found a way to help people in long-distance relationships experience the intimate feelings that come with sharing a drink. Their creation is a pair of glass tumblers that incorporate colored LEDs, liquid sensors, and wireless internet links. When either person picks up a glass, their partner's glass will glow with a soft red light. And when one person puts a glass to their lips, sensors make the rim of the other glass glow bright white, letting the partner know that their other half is taking a sip. The inventors say the glasses help recreate the benefits of communal drinking, which they call an important social behavior that helps cement relationships. The glasses will be unveiled next month at a conference on computer-human interactions in Montreal.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we'd love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. Just email your feedback to podcasts@newscientist.com. And now, back to our show. You'd think that by now, physicists would be ready to give Einstein a break, but that's not how it works. Even though Einstein's theory of special relativity, including his famous equation E equals mc squared, is now more than 100 years old, it's still open to challengers. Recently, an international team of scientists subjected E equals mc squared to its toughest test yet. MIT physicist David Pritchard led one half of the team. We caught up with him in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Dr. Pritchard, there are a lot of equations that seem to govern the way things happen in our universe, and I know physicists like you like to put those equations to the test whenever they can, but E equals mc squared is so well known, so widely accepted, does it really need another test?
Well, the point you have to realize is that that particular formula, E equals mc squared, follows from a theory, which is Einstein's theory of special relativity. And the question with any theory is, does it actually represent the way the world works? I mean, it may be a very good idea, self-consistent, mathematically correct, but ultimately it's supposed to be a description of the world, and the way to determine that is to make a measurement and see if it, in fact, does describe the world.
Right, and just to recap for everyone, the part of the world that this equation describes is the relationship between energy and mass. E is for energy, m is for mass, and the c squared, the speed of light squared, is a very large number, which suggests that a little bit of mass gives you a lot of energy. And so are we actually talking about measuring a very little bit of mass?
Yes, indeed, we're talking about measuring a very little bit of mass, because even if we converted a couple of grams of mass into energy, it would blow MIT sky high.
Okay, so this is something obviously we don't want to see happen. Outline the strategy for me. How does this test of E equals mc squared unfold?
Well, it works pretty much the way you would think. Namely, you have to measure the energy somehow, and you have to measure the mass that is converted into that energy by some process, and then see if, in fact, the proportionality of c squared is, in fact, the ratio of those of the energy and that mass. And so at MIT, we have developed procedures to measure the mass of individual atoms very, very accurately. And in fact, what we measure is the mass difference between two states of a nucleus that emit some X-ray particles or gamma-ray particles because they're higher energy. And so the mass, getting back to your first question, is extremely small. It's much smaller than the mass of the atom. In fact, it's about just a couple of 10,000ths of the mass of the atom is the only change that we see.
Now, as I understand it, the energy part of this equation was measured somewhere else, and your job, maybe the short straw in this whole game, was to measure that small amount of mass.
Yes, that's right. The energy was measured by looking at the gamma rays that are given out in this interaction, And that was done at the Institut Laue-Langevin in Grenoble, France, by a team that consisted largely of people from NIST who actually had a particular very high precision spectrometer to measure the wavelength, and then people from Laue-Langevin who run a reactor and the neutrons from the reactor initiate the particular reaction.
Okay, so they've got their measurement of the energy on that side. You've got the mass to measure. How small of a mass are we talking about, and exactly how did you do it?
Well, in fact, in grams, it would be 10 to the minus 37 kilograms or something like that. We don't think of it. Of course, we don't use those units. They're not very practical. What we use are atomic mass units, which is just defined by picking carbon-12 as having 12 mass units. That's the internationally accepted definition. Then there are some other measurements that tie that to mass in kilograms.
Okay.
Then the second part of your question was, how do we, in fact, measure that mass? And the answer is, we measure the mass by putting the particle in a very well-known magnetic field and measuring how rapidly it goes around. And to measure that accurately, we actually have to trap the particle for several minutes. And then we have to, it's going around at something like 5 million times a second. And so we let it go around, well, that would be maybe a billion times or something like that. And then we measure, we actually, in our experiment, cannot measure the number of times it's gone around. We only measure the fraction of extra last turn. So it's gone around 1,300,000,027, and we measure the 0.27, and then from a bunch of different times we can infer what the numbers out front were.
Now, I know there's a lot of technical details here, but there's one thing that I'm curious about. I'm imagining this kind of containment vessel. You talked about a magnetic field which is trapping this charged particle. How can you keep track of one single particle? How do you know there's just one in there?
It took us several years to get to that point, so that's a very good question. First, we had to build a superconducting detector that was sensitive enough to see the charge of just that one particle oscillating in the trap. When the charge oscillates, it induces a minuscule current in the electrodes of the trap, and then we made a detector that would detect that current. So that's how we measure the motion of the particle.
And so what is the verdict? What did you find with regard to E equals MC squared?
Well, I have to tell you one caveat that people who do this kind of comparison should do, and that is you have to be absolutely certain that you believe your measurement of the mass, and the people at NIST who are in charge of their experiment had to be absolutely certain that they would believe their measurement of the energy. Even if they knew there was a discrepancy, no one would go back and say we should reanalyze the experiment. No, it had to be we believed in those. So it was a momentous Friday when we finally compared our results. And what we found was that we basically confirmed Einstein's prediction about a factor of 50 better than it had been done before.
Wow. So now that really sounds like a huge step forward. Does it change anything in terms of our understanding of the universe? It seems that it would make the case that much tighter for Einstein, but where does it take us?
Well, you're right. In one sense, it doesn't really extend our knowledge to anything new. We just are more solid on what we are already taking as one of the fundamental tenets of 20th century physics. So that's nice to know that it's pounded down a little bit. Had we gotten a discrepancy, that may well have led to some new insight, but that's sort of the high watermark. I mean, from our point of view, we would hope for a very large discrepancy and then a realization that something new was operating, or we would expect, we would hope, well, okay, we confirmed this dead on as happened, and so now we know this 50 times better. It would be horrible to be stuck in the middle. Fortunately, we weren't.
Excellent. Now, do you think that these kinds of tests are getting us, when we're subjecting the laws of nature to such exacting scrutiny, does that get us any closer to understanding what the origin of these laws are? Why does E equals MC squared rather than some other relationship? Is this helping us understand why the universe is built the way it is?
Well, occasionally there are other theories. In fact, quite often there are other theories that people come up with. And they basically don't go forward with those theories because they disagree with some benchmark, like E doesn't equal MC squared. If someone comes up with a theory where E doesn't equal MC squared by a little bit, then they would probably publish that theory, and then there would be a lot more interest in doing this particular measurement. However, at the present time, there aren't alternatives to special relativity that are taken seriously, in part because of experiments like ours.
Well, Dr. Pritchard, thanks very much for telling us about this, and also thank you for going to all the effort to assuring us that Einstein was in fact correct.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on the show.
Dr. David Pritchard is Associate Director of MIT's Research Laboratory for Electronics. His efforts to confirm E equals MC squared were recently chronicled in New Scientist magazine.
Subscribe to New Scientist magazine, and every week you'll enjoy a comprehensive roundup of the latest science and technology news, along with the listing of the best science jobs from around the world. Subscribe today, and you'll save 40% off our annual price, and get unlimited free access to the entire content of NewScientist.com. To take advantage of this offer, just visit NewScientist.com/2504. That's NewScientist.com/2504 for this week's best ideas delivered right to your door.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the March 11th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, the truth behind the headlines. In the wake of a major scandal, the media spotlight is shining on stem cell research like never before. We sort out the promise from the pitfalls. Hacking Hollywood. The entertainment industry is launching a new technology to thwart piracy, but could it backfire? And Talking Disaster, 3 one-on-one interviews with scientists who found themselves working amid the wreckage of 9/11, New Orleans, and the Asian tsunami. All this plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission control. Transmission concluded.